The level of resentment where you'd basically be like, I don't care if we ever actually get a better world, I just care that those who I disagree with suffer. It's like, oh my god, it's pure resentment.
Hey, hey, everybody! Welcome to Owls at Dawn. We're just two dudes from Southern California who studied philosophy, politics, and religion around the world and decided to start a podcast where we could bullshit with impunity. I am Austin Hayden Smith.
And I am Troy Polidori.
And we are going to get into it this week talking about Nietzsche and ressentiment and like some political shit, I'm sure. But before we do, we're going to start off the episode the way we start off every motherfucking episode with the shitty minute. This week, it is Troy's turn to rant about what it is that is really goosing his gipper or something. I don't know. Grinding his gear, galloping around his gooch. Troy, what got you?
I don't think I have a gooch. I don't even know what a gipper is.
You know, like win one for the gipper.
Oh, well then isn't me then, right?
Yeah, but you could have a gipper metaphorically. I don't know. I mean, if the conceptual penis is a thing, could the gipper not also be a conceptual apparatus that we can use to talk about like your chode or something?
Oh, like the big other is your gipper?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I'm certainly not going to goose my big other, but okay, whatevs. My shitty minute this week is actually, we've been off a little bit the past couple of weeks because of finals week and all this crap. So my shitty minute's been building for a while. I think like 2 or 3 weeks at this point.
So you've been blue-balled for a little bit is what you're saying.
I don't know about blue-balled as much as like a raging inferno.
Oh, no.
And my shitty minute this week will actually have some relevance to our main topic, so hopefully it will be a nice little segue. So there's this dude on Twitter, and who also blogs under the name No Opinion. His name is Noah Smith. He's a finance professor at like some university on the East Coast or something. I forget which one. He's a real mm-hmm. smart guy. I've read his blog for a couple of years off and on, and he's done a lot of good work on economics that I've been able to learn from being a novice in that area. Certainly don't dislike him at all. But he does rage against sort of left political or far left political rhetoric quite a bit, especially lately since the election, as these dividing lines between centrists and far left people have really come to the fore. I don't know if you heard about this new book called Hitler's American Model. That nope. James Whitman from Yale published recently. He was on Doug Hedewood's podcast, Behind the News, recently. That's where I heard about it first. There's a couple other podcasts that have kind of talked about his thesis. And I guess the general idea, I haven't read the book, but the general idea is that the Nazis, when they were first trying to build their judicial system and their sort of judicial tradition of how they would interpret who's Jewish and who's not, who's of a particular race, legally speaking, so they could sort of make consistent laws about it. They looked to America as a model because America was the largest racial state in the world in terms of, you know, defining who's black and who's not. In America, we had the one drop rule and we had miscegenation laws based upon if you had one drop of black blood, you were considered black. Or Native American, or whatever it was, and that the Nazis looked to the American model in the South as sort of an example that they could use for how to make their own racial laws, and that in some cases actually they thought the American rules were too stringent, like they couldn't do a one drop rule in Germany because probably too many Germans had one drop of Jewish blood in them, and so then they built their laws kind of based upon miscegenation laws in the U.S. and upon Jim Crow and stuff like that, which, I mean, that idea I think has been around for a while, but I guess what Whitman has done is he's kind of really gone into not just the times in Mein Kampf where Hitler talks about America as a model, but just to the actual Nazi-based law that was drafted that takes up American law as its forebear. And that is interesting. I thought, well, that's really interesting to think about. I never really had thought about the fact that, you know, a large part of why, probably a big part of why Jim Crow ended up becoming unpopular after the Civil Rights era was in part very you know, in a very small degree in part to seeing ourselves in the mirror in some cases with Nazism, like the American race law taken to its, you know, its extreme and extermination. Now, Noah Smith, back to the original, he tweeted that basically a lot of the rhetoric coming from the left using this sort of, this book's being published and it being in the news cycle or the academic news cycle or whatever, he called it blood libel, and saying that basically if you want to be an academic nowadays, you have to blood libel American history and basically just talk about how horrible American history is and America's only done evil things ever, and that he just thought it was ridiculous to do that. And he went in this tweet storm and he mentioned, like, if you want to be a serious academic, you have to blood libel. And there's all these things that America's done that's been terrible. You know, Native Americans, Chinese, obviously African Americans, Japanese internment. But then he lists after that all the great things America has done, which is repealing Jim Crow laws and reparations for Japanese internment and whatever else, you know, all the, and it was, you know, interestingly and comedically, he just named off all the things that were basically admitting fault for all the bad things that were forced after a long period of trying to ignore it, which was kind of funny to think about. But, like, this entire idea, and I see this, you know, I really hate both sides-ism. I don't like to do the both sides are wrong kind of thing. Let's be good centers, good centrists. That's actually kind of the problem here. But there is some truth to the fact that when people do historical scholarship like this, the point of it is not to blood libel, clearly. And sometimes people do that. And they do want to just find every little thing they can see that's, oh, here's how America's bad, here's how capitalism is evil, here's how... It's just a morality play, basically. And that entire idea is just so asinine and unhelpful to actual analysis and making a better world. Like, it doesn't mean we just ignore the past and say that, you know, oh, it happened, let's just forget about it or anything. But, I mean, even Marx could spend the beginning of Capital talking about all the amazing things that capitalism has been able to do and its immense power. And we should be able to do that. Like, we should be able to say that rather than jumping to everything being a morality play, just saying, look, it's the truth that Nazis used American race law as a sort of harbinger or as a sort of example they could borrow from in certain cases. It doesn't mean that America is Nazi Germany, nor does it mean that America is America the pure that you learn in elementary school or whatever. It's just historical scholarship, and use it as that. It just seems like, I don't know if this is a more recent phenomenon or if it's just the fact that because of Twitter, everyone has access to everyone else's like immediate thoughts. But it seems like this is just coming more and more to the surface in terms of like this ultimate hatred and charging others and with sort of immorality. I don't know. I don't know that my thoughts are super well formed other than the idea that it fucking sucks that we can't just like do historical scholarship and think about things that have happened in the past and what we can learn from them and how we can adjust in the future to do better without basically just trying to relitigate history. Like we're going to win anything by doing that. You see what I'm getting?
Yeah, I'm totally with you. The one thing that I think that I get frustrated about is that there's a real sort of myopic, there's a myopic logic in that type of criticism, in Noah Smith's criticism, because it's looking at things as like little tiny component parts rather than taking not only what you said into consideration, but also even broadening it out into a larger sort of more a totalizing viewpoint that all of us are just sort of together in this process. And sometimes the radical voices, even if they are engaging in blood libel, sometimes that shit is useful if the analysis kind of swing things in the right direction or pushes things in a direction that are useful for the greater conversation. So it's useful from an analytic perspective, and especially if you're an academic and you're somebody who wants to be a part of this broader discussion, then you kind of need to step back, I think, sometimes and allow for these radical voices to exist within their space from an analytic perspective, unless they're saying, therefore, go out and like murder people and shit like that. But that's obviously not what academic research does. It's about making sort of like these intense analyses of specific cases from particular perspectives under particular conditions in order to make particular claims that then all fit within that larger totalization. So I just don't understand why we're so quick to be resistant to that totalization process or that totalizing process. And that seems what Noah Smith's criticism is ultimately guilty of, is that it's just extremely myopic in its sort of logical paradigm.
Yeah, I mean, I get his frustration because I feel that way sometimes too, right? Where every little bit of contemporary news especially has to automatically fit on one side of this culture war. And I can see why he sees that existing in academia as well, where any historical scholarship that exists has to automatically fit into a narrative of America is Satan or America is ultimately pure and is Jesus Christ's like weapon for saving the world. Right. Obviously, both are incredibly false, but that doesn't mean, like, he uses the analogy of blood libel, right? Like, accusing Jews of poisoning the water or, you know, using the blood of Christian children for, you know, sacrifices or whatever the blood libel originally was meant to be. The whole point of that is that was false, right? Is that that was false and made up in order to be an excuse to persecute Jews. Whereas historical scholarship, by its very nature, is not false. It's true. Sometimes is it misused used as a weapon to persecute or to like weaponized? Sure, it is. And we really shouldn't do that. It's not very helpful. But that doesn't mean you just reject the scholarship. Like, that seems an obvious misanalogy in that point. So, like, yeah, it just frustrates me that I understand his frustration and why he feels that way, but just the response just seems to perpetuate the same sort of back and forth. That's very unhelpful. So actually, you know, knowledge is good, yo. Like, gaining knowledge is good. Can we just gain knowledge and not automatically get some, like, drop of dopamine because it confirms all of our, like, moralizing views in the world? Just gain knowledge.
Yeah, give us all the knowledge. Yeah, all of it. Yeah, I can remember I was chatting with someone on Facebook the other day, and I've really cut back my social media engagement of late, but every once in a while I get embroiled in interesting discussions. And I've been in this discussion with this guy, Jan, for quite a while, and he said something along the lines of, you know, I asked him, he's like a reformed theonomist type of guy, and, you know, like Greg Bonson and shit like that. And I asked him, I was like, oh, have you ever read like Paul Tillich? You know, because he talks about theonomic ethics and theonomy and ethics. And obviously it's not from within a reformed tradition, but I was like, oh, have you ever read Tillich? Just trying to suggest something that might be, you know, it's conceptually related, you know, that there is some sort of there's some sort of similarity there. So he might find some use in it. Plus, at the same time, I'm also kind of like subtly trying to challenge him, even though he doesn't really know that with that book recommendation. But, you know, that's also what I'm trying to do at the same time. And he was like, nah, I'll just stick to my Bonson. And I was like, dude, read it all. Like, why would you ever restrict yourself and limit yourself? And then as soon as he said that, I started thinking and I did a little bit of research and I wondered, in the history of humanity, has there ever been a culture that was so quick to say no? Has there ever been a culture that was so quick to indulge in negation as the contemporary culture? And I'm not saying that we're the only culture that has. Obviously, negation and logical negation has existed for years. Semantic negation has existed for centuries. But what I wonder is there a sense in which contemporary culture, social media, information tech culture is just thoroughly rife with this type of negativity where the disposition of no in resistance and restriction and limitation is what ultimately is kind of like our instinctual first line of defense when we engage socially. And I just wonder if we're just so thoroughly defined by negation. And, you know, I think about other cultures. You know, you study anthropologists where they say they present you something and they just accept, they just affirm. Or they tell creation myths that are all contradictory You know, this happened, and then someone else says, and this happened. Not no, this happened. It's this happened and this happened. But to a Western ear, they're totally contradictory. But to them, no, it's okay. They just kind of pile on affirmative stories, even though they may seem contradictory, but they're not contradictory from within those cultures' logical paradigms. And I wonder if there's something about our culture and about Westernization and about maybe it has something to do with like a post-Christian world, a post-Enlightenment world. I'm not sure, but I would love to study this or learn about this more, about the history of negation and how our culture in particular is so defined by that limited paradigm of thinking, you know? Like, I don't know, just embrace it all, read it all, engage it all, entertain it all, learn about it all.
Yeah, not just like a culture of negation in contrast to sort of affirmation, but just like in the sense that even things that aren't contradictory or don't have an immediate tension are proposed in a relationship of negation, right? So like Our first instinct isn't to say, well, how do these two things fit together? Or how can these two things both be true at the same time? Our immediate instinct is just to say, no, yours is wrong, even just because your emphasis is wrong. Mine has a greater emphasis on the truth, or something like that. Like, it's really vague, but
yeah.
I see what you're getting at, where we immediately want to give the no to anything new.
Yeah, I think there's something interesting in the logical preconditions to that. I heard once someone said that 7 out of 10 things that come out of our mouth, it was some psychological study, 7 out of 10 things that come out of our mouths are negative. And I don't know, I think there's something really interesting to be explored there. I would love to do a sort of genealogical criticism of no.
And you know, the first thing I thought when you said that was, that's not true. All right, so for our main segment today, we're going to continue talking about a similar subject here. We wanted to talk a little bit about Nietzsche and resentments, or resentiment. Is that how you pronounce it correctly in the French?
Resentiment.
Do you think this is kind of in the air today, Austin? Resentiment?
Oh my God, this is the air today.
It's the very air we breathe. This is, you know, water.
It's one part oxygen, one part resentment. yeah, it is. So the sort of basic, simple definition of resentment is this idea of envy or hatred, right, towards another person. You know, we think of it as resentment, but for Nietzsche, it has to do with an hostility that you might experience towards another person because of a sort of weak or reactive mind towards that other person's position or towards that person's possessions or something along those lines. So both Kierkegaard and Nietzsche talk about resentment quite a bit. But it's it basically has to do with your own inferiority or failure, and then you project it onto another. And that person becomes a sort of scapegoat, you know, the guilty party. So that person must bear the brunt of your own feelings of inferiority. Now, of course, you're not aware that you feel inferior. You're not aware that you're scapegoating another person. Otherwise, the scapegoating myth, and Troy, this is interesting. I was just telling you beforehand, I've been reading a lot about René Girard, who talks about the scapegoat myth. If you realize that it's a scapegoat, then it's not a scapegoat. So archaic religion makes sense in the scapegoating because they aren't aware of the fact that they are scapegoating. So there has to be just a blind, unconscious guilt ascribed to that other, right? And so that's what happens in resentment. Resentment is that idea that you feel that inferiority, you project it onto another or a group of others or onto a system or something like that. And you do that in reaction, in a weak reaction to your own sense of failure.
That's the key for Nietzsche, right? That's reactive. And there's a contradiction in the sort of heart of it, right? I mean, to be envious of something and to hate it at the same time is a contradiction. Because if you hate something, that means you're basically saying that it's bad. And if you envy it, then you're saying that I want it, so it's good or valuable. So there's this contradiction at the heart of it, so it's not purely rational. And part of it has to be unconscious, right? You can't realize it's happening. And it's reactive in the sense that it's not actually a creative force, but reacts to a lack right, to what the person doesn't have. In Nietzsche's Genealogy of Morals, he talks about the master and slave moralities, right, as these two kind of paradigms, where the master morality has this these masters who just naturally have power, and they, with their power over others, are able to just creatively sort of make their own values. And the things they value are the things that are true of them, right? Their own strength, their achievement of glory and wealth and happiness and all these things, right? They're good, and so they call them good. It's really easy. And Nietzsche says that that's great for the masters. They're normally a lot more stable mentally, but the problem is they don't really have a whole lot of depth. He calls them happy idiots at one point because they never actually struggle enough to create some inner depth. That's to contrast to slave morality. And slave morality is this force that happens in reaction to master morality. And the slaves basically hate and envy. They resent the masters for having that power over them. And so in reaction, they begin to value all the opposites of the things that the masters have and call the masters evil. And Nietzsche says slave morality is where the notions of good and evil are born in the first place. Because the masters don't call anything evil. They don't really even care enough about the slaves to call them evil, right? Whereas the slaves are only creating these values in response to or in reaction to the masters, calling them evil, and then everything opposite of them good. So slave morality celebrates suffering and poverty and humility and all these things, right? We know these are sort of like the Christian values. Also, Nietzsche would say the Platonic values of like wisdom as well. And Nietzsche isn't entirely against slave morality. He thinks it's really interesting that, or he thinks the slaves are actually interesting because they sort of have this intellection underneath everything, right? They actually, because they suffer, because they have this force against them, they have to sort of think deeply and sort of cognize the masters as something, right? And to develop theory in a sense. But the problem is it's all based on resentment, so they're incredibly unhappy. And they develop this bad conscience, Nietzsche calls it, which is this sort of inner feelings of guilt, or these, he calls them instincts that you turn inward on yourself. So you're not allowed to care about the things the masters care about, the things we're naturally good at, you know, as animals, as beasts. You can't just go out and fuck everything. You can't go out and gather all the possessions you want. You can't go out and just, you know, destroy Austin at basketball one-on-one. You have to let him score a few points so that he knows, he thinks that he's pretty good still. You can't do those things even though you want to, because you'll feel bad, right? You have this inner guilt. So you turn those instincts inwards and use them against yourself. And Nietzsche thinks this is like, just we cause our own suffering by doing this, in a sense, internally. All that to say, can we use like master and slave morality, you think, to analyze culture right now? I kind of think that we can.
Yeah. So you wanted to kind of delve into this. We've been talking the last few weeks a little bit more theoretically about ethics, and you were triggered, I think, by something in the news cycle or on social media where you said, dude, we should talk about Nietzsche and Resentiment. So I'm curious, what was it that kind of instigated this? I mean, besides the sort of obvious if you could see his face right now, his eyes were literally rolling. He's like, everything?
Yeah, I don't think there is like a particular thing I can remember triggering me other than every day.
But yeah, I guess, how do you want to tackle this, especially if you want to do it in a more concrete sense? So in what way do you think that we might be able to use the master-slave morality binary to analyze culture today?
I mean, I don't know that it's as simple as just being masters and slaves. These two groups, like Nietzsche's talking about in like ancient Greece and comparing it to Christian morality, replacing that. But just in the sense of our valuations being based on and stemming from, originating in Resentiment, right? That's the idea, right? I think is really interesting, because we tend to think that our values are either purely rational, right? We come to them because we think deeply and logically about what's to be valued, and then we decide, well, these good things are to be valued for some reason, right? Or they come from like a religious source, like from on high or transcendence or whatever it is, right? But Nietzsche's sort of innovation is to say actually, the natural state of affairs is for the powerful to rule the powerless, right? And when that doesn't happen, when all of a sudden the weak are allowed to rule for whatever reason, it isn't because there was a gift given from on high or because people thought really rationally and deeply about what's good and then convinced one another. It's because there's this underlying feeling of incredible resentment for those in power. Those valuations stem from that originally. And if you wanted to use that as a hypothesis, you would predict, to test that hypothesis, that when those valuations come under fire or in check, that resentment would just flow forth like an open sluice gate, and you would like drown in the resentment. And man, do you see that all over the place right now when we're having sort of this battle over our valuations, right? You think between conservative, between liberal, and then far left, these three kind of groups that most everyone tends to fit in some case. Whenever we have these battles over Twitter or in culture in the news cycle, whatever it is, it's so obvious to me, at least, that resentment is entirely what this is all based on. I mean, it's pretty obvious that a lot of liberals have talked about how Trump winning the election and the conservative backlash against elitist liberal culture under Obama is entirely based on resentment. And that seems kind of true to me. It really is. Like, you have this sort of elite movement of individuals, college-educated, white liberal, doing pretty well, even though we've been sort of through the Great Recession and everything. And then a large swath of, you know, white working-class people who are very resentful of that fact. And so they're kind of getting their revenge through the election of Trump, which, I mean, in many cases, they don't even really care if Trump doesn't actually help them. As long as liberal tears happen or occur, then everything has been won. Yeah, and so that's also true, I think, of liberals as well, right? And that it's not just purely a conservative thing. Whenever something happens in the news cycle, especially if Trump does something stupid, there's like this immediate schadenfreude, right? This immediate sort of pleasure at the misery of others. Whenever you hear about how Trump's actually miserable in the White House and wants to quit and is getting fat or eating, you know, McDonald's meals or whatever, like, you get this immediate schadenfreude of, yeah, he's such an idiot, I'm so right about everything. Or even just the idea that, like, for some people, that everybody who voted for Trump deserves to lose their health care. And it's just like, oh my God. The level of resentment where you'd basically be like, I don't care if we ever actually get a better world. I just care that those who I disagree with or who are wrong intellectually suffer.
Yeah.
It's like, oh my God, it's pure resentment. And it's naked. Like, it's not even covered over anymore with actual valuations. It's like coming to the fore.
Yeah, it's super nasty. It's super nasty. I mean, I think there are a couple things to say. Just on a very superficial level, I'm fatigued, man. I have serious political fatigue. At least it's been interesting in Ireland and the UK because the experience is different. Things in the UK are similarly tense. They just had a snap election that went in a very interesting way, very positive for the Labour Party and for a candidate that nobody thought could win in the mainstream media. That was the narrative anyway. And then in Ireland, there's a lot of unrest, but it seems to be taking place under different conditions. There's still anger. There still, of course, is that there are expressions of resentment that are going to undercut the political discourse. But American news, American social media, popular social media discourse, I am really tired of this contempt. I don't remember who it was. It was someone either at Harvard or maybe he was a Harvard psychologist who was saying something about how he thinks the sort of defining characteristic of the contemporary popular political battles is contempt, and that is what really defines this sort of the or results from the silo effect of, you know, kind of Republicans versus Democrats or left versus right or us versus them, is that it's really based on this contempt of that other position or the contempt of the other side. And I think he's absolutely right that there is just so much contempt, so much anger, so much bitterness that it really is kind of wearing on me, and it's making it difficult for me to really even kind of care. And it's, in one sense, it's been nice because it's been freeing. I've been able to kind of detach myself from trying to be so caught up with the day-to-day 24-hour news cycles that really don't introduce new information. It's just a sort of repetition of that ressentiment again. And so I've been able to kind of throw myself into, I think, bigger projects, more creative projects. But it really has been draining, man.
So yeah, one thing I wanted to ask you is, given that you're kind of existing or seeing this whole thing happen, you know, almost vicariously, like you're seeing it away from your home country, do you think a lot of this is just internet fueled in the sense that, you know, the Twitter and social media is basically the unrefined id of the country, and, you know, people don't have a chance to like sit back and think about what they do, so they just respond in this horrifically resentful way, and then that becomes publicized as the way things actually are? That's kind of like the deflationary account of the whole thing. Do you think that's kind of true, or is there that missing something?
I don't want to be reductive and say it's only because of social media, because at the same time, I think that the way that people think nowadays also informs social media. So there's a sort of co-constituting relation there, right? So I don't want to just blame it on the medium of information technology. I haven't read Paul Virilio much, except for, like, you know, quotes and things like that. But I know he talks a little bit about speed and capitalism, and it's something that I've been really interested in. I just finished a book called Wanderlust by Rebecca Solnit that I may be talking about in my sticky leaves later. Stick around.
Spoiler.
But she talks a lot about walking and this idea of becoming more attuned to the sort of biological rhythms of our bodies and things like that that you get from walking that that are different in an environment where you're in a car that's traveling at 70 miles an hour or something like that. So I think there's something to do with this idea of speed, not just in the sense of being in a vehicle, but also in the sense of the speed with which information is dispersed that contributes to this. And obviously social media is probably the primary site where this occurs, or the primary medium where this speed occurs, and at the same time that also conditions the speed and demands for more speed. And so I don't want to be reductive, but at the same time, I also do want to acknowledge that I do think that what social media does, maybe more than anything, is it intensifies not just speed in a miles per hour sense, but in an intensity, in the sense that it deepens, it thickens, it maximizes the mimetic tendency, right? The sort of copying, the imitation copying. I mean, meme culture, everybody knows meme culture, right? It's this repetition of the same thing that somebody else said. And you share and you like and you copy and you paste and you disperse through your various platforms. You've got your Google Plus, so it shares to this and it shares to that and it shares to this. Or you've got your Twitter synced to your Facebook and your Facebook synced to your Instagram and all these various things and your Tumblr account. And so there's this sense at which there's also this mimetic copying that's taking place. And so there's this confluence of forces. You've got speed, you've got intensity and variation, and then you've got mimesis and copying and imitation. And all of this is creating this strange swirling anxiety of political ressentiment in a heightened sense, you know? So if Nietzsche was talking in the, you know, mid to late 1800s, when was genealogy written? Like 1870s or something, 1880s?
Somewhere around there, yeah.
Yeah, so if he's writing at the end of the 19th century and he's talking about this as being an issue, how much more so is it taking place under the conditions of contemporary culture? And I think that that is part of the problem. So in one sense, yes, it is definitely a problem of social media. But in another sense, I don't think it's reductive. Like you said, you don't want to be deflationary. And I don't think you are, because I think I get what you're getting at. But I think just for listeners, I think it's clear that we're not just blaming the internet. You know, it's not as though we would have pure communication otherwise and the internet is somehow sullying it, you know. Rather, it's there is this strange connection in a negative sense that's taking place with ressentiment, as being refracted through the lens or refracted through the space or the matrix, if you will, of social media in the internet. And so I don't know, because I've heard a couple of people, ironically, through the medium of Twitter, that have talked about how they've echoed a similar sentiment that you've said in the past, where they say, look, the real work is being done at the ground level. Some guys from DSA, the Democratic Socialists of America, that I follow, that I really like, because they're trying not to engage in this bickering, this battle of contempt that I was talking about earlier, this situation of negative reciprocity. They're trying not to engage in that as much on social media, but rather are using their Twitter to encourage and to create and inform, but they don't get involved so much in that bitchy back and forth. And they've tried to get sucked into it a little, people have tried to suck them into it, but they've done a pretty good job of resisting. And they've said, hey, listen, things are tough and it may seem shitty on social media, but I truly believe that at the ground level, things are happening and things are changing at the local, at the material, at the physical level. And so, you know, I mean, I think in one sense, yeah, it's intensified because of where we get our news and how much we're plugged into social media. So it seems that the world is on fire, but at the same time, maybe there is some other stuff that's taking place.
Yeah, I mean, I brought up that thesis of, you know, the internet being the problem because I don't agree with it. I think you're absolutely right to describe it as an intensifier. It takes the initial conditions that are already there and then just exacerbates them.
Right. Well, the internet is just a technology like any other technology. Like, a fucking stick used to help an ape cross the river is a technology. So everything is technology. And the internet is no different, except that it does it in a particular way. Right? Not that it's no different, but obviously it does it under different conditions. So it's a different type of technology. So obviously it's not some sort of like deus ex machina that's going to just like create shit out of nowhere.
Yeah, yeah. This resentment that we're talking about it's been there, I think, for a long time. And there seems to be something
human, all too human.
Yeah, and it's something specifically American about it too. And I know it exists everywhere in some respects, but there's something particular about the American experience that because we're so individualistic and focus so much on self-worth being things like, you know, having a family and making enough money and all these kind of things, right? We think of ourselves as being totally free because we're so individualistic. But actually, that thing that in many cases makes us totally unfree, because we're judged, even self-judged, by these things, all these things. And since we're so independent, we're not allowed to sort of look at how social contracts affect the outcomes of our life. And so if you don't succeed and have a lot of money, rather than looking at the social conditions that in large part cause that, you have to trace it back to your own choices. That's the American individualism, right? And it's totally, you know, factually inaccurate, but it's the way that we're trained to do it. And so rather than seeing all of our failures as actually our fault, because who could actually deal with that? I mean, the anxiety and the shame and the guilt that would produce because we fail so often. We have to lash out at something else, and so we can't sort of actually go out and try and do some social analysis and figure out why things are the way they are. We just have to find some other individual who's at fault for it.
Yeah, and that fits really well into the idea of the scapegoat that you get in Ressentiment in Nietzsche, and then obviously that you get in René Girard, which is someone who you and I both read a lot of in times past and who I have kind of recently rediscovered through just kind of happenstance. It was Amazon recommended it because this book was similar to other books that I had purchased on Amazon. And so I started reading some Girard again. But yeah, it does seem to be particularly American. And I wonder if a lot of it has to do with the particularity of American evangelicalism and American capitalism, you know, obviously being related to one another, that is unique in particular ways. I wrote a Facebook post last night, and it's pretty short, but I'll read it to you right now. It's just something I was reading Girard, and I kind of got inspired, and I said, greed is not the engine of capitalism. Imitation is. Mimetic desire, which is a term coined by René Girard, describes the tendency of persons to desire an object because an other desires it. The desire for this common object leads to violence or conflict. This is the sort of basis of human civilization under archaic religions for Girard. And then I said, in this mimetic desire is what Girard actually calls original sin. So the desire for the other thing. He talks about Shakespeare, and I think it is it Two Gentlemen of Verona, where there's the love triangle where they're battling over the woman that's the object of both of their affection, but it's the idea that the one guy wants her because the other guy wants her, and the other guy wants her because the other guy wants her. And so there's this idea that Girard sees that he thinks is a sort of, let's say, an internal logic to the emergence of society that exists through this process of mimetic desire, imitation. I want something because you want that something, right? And that's something that exists kind of dispersed throughout the field. You were just talking about that with America. You know, I want the car because the other person has the car. You know, I want the 4-pack taco meal from Taco Bell because the commercial tells me that I want it and other people want it, so I want it. I want to listen to the new Radiohead album because it was released on the top 10 list as number 2, and the number 1 album is the new, I don't know, whoever the fuck it is, and so I want that too, but I want it because the top 10 list is telling me to. Psychologists refer to this as external conditioning, right? And so it's that idea of mimetic desire. So then what I said after that is, so capitalism then is essentially mimetic desire writ large, right? And social media then is mimetic desire writ large and fucking crazy intensified on steroids. And then I said, the entire market mechanism is built on creating desires that consumers must seek to satisfy. Not only does this create a field of conceptual and often material violence, but it also creates a world of determinism. And then capitalism's biggest lie is that it stimulates freedom, but it does not. It perpetuates control because it perpetuates imitation and mimetic desire. And it's so interesting to think then that maybe, even though we think we are advanced and post-enlightened individuals, but that really we're just repeating these sort of archaic, mythical traditions of desire for the other, and then we have to find those scapegoats upon which we project our own anxieties, our own fears, our own whatever. Nietzsche would refer to it as our own ressentiment. Girard does not, but maybe there's a way that there's a confluence there. And it's this idea then that so that we project it onto the scapegoat so that we can purge the community of the guilt. The problem is that you have a community like America where it's not just a community, you know? So there's no like joint scapegoat that the American people can join around, you know? Maybe there was during the American Revolutionary War, you had the crown, right? That they could bond over. But now we are so dispersed and we are so tribally composed that we all have these kind of various identities, and as such, there are various scapegoats that we are constantly kind of sacrificing, you know, at all times. So Republicans have the scapegoats of you know, certain liberal commentators or the liberal media, right? Ah, it's the liberal media, the mainstream media. That's a scapegoat for them. And then liberals have, it's corporate America, that can be a scapegoat for them, and shareholders, that can be a scapegoat for them. And then Christians have scapegoats. Oh, it's Mexican immigrants, or the non-Christians, or oh, it's, you know, the forces of Satan. And then, of course, if you're an American Christian, then you can have all of these various identities, and you have all these various scapegoats that you're constantly projecting your sacrificial intentions onto at all times. And so there's this constant need to sacrifice and to kill the animal. And in that sense, it seems very archaic. There is this like internal archaic logic that seems to be defining or that seems to define much of contemporary Western culture that is really interesting, I think. I don't know. I think there's got to be a way out of it. If mimetic desire, then if this tendency is original sin for Girard, and I don't disagree with it, that it may be something to, or that maybe that's a useful way or an interesting way to think about original sin. And then we can think about the kind of master slave morality. Maybe there's a way to overcome it, you know, through the sort of death of God, Christian experience, vindication of the prophetic tradition, something along those lines, but in like a sort of post-Christian death of God, Hegelian alpha boom sense.
Yeah, I think there's kind of two strains you can take these Nietzsche ideas as far as like a cure. One is sort of the right wing reactionary strain of Nietzsche, and this is what you see most associated with Nietzsche and like the alt right, and even going back to like Strauss and uses of Plato and stuff, and on the conservative political side, or even like who's the German philosopher Carl Schmitt, jurist and philosopher, as being basically like, well, if this is the way it works, then we have to weaponize it. We have to weaponize the resentment against some enemy, and use that enemy to then define who is our friend and who is our in-group, and then fight against them. Like, it's inevitable. This resentment's inevitable. You have to use it and build it to get the best possible unified social fabric you can. That, I think, is very popular right now on a number of different sides. I mean, even on the liberal side, this whole, like, well, the red states are done. We might as well just fuck them and let them die from lack of healthcare. And if their food stamps get taken away, who gives a shit? The whole, you know, Democrats in the House cheering when the House passed the healthcare bill kind of seems like a little bit of that, right?
Yeah, weren't they singing? Didn't they sing a song? Like, didn't they sing "Na Na 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 Hey Hey Goodbye" or some shit?
Yeah,
like that too?
Yeah, because the Republicans in the House were apparently writing their death warrant. Yeah, good luck with that.
Yeah, but not only that, like, how fucking childish and how just filled with bitterness are you, you know?
It's clearly a game to them, yeah. I mean, that's all they see it as. Yeah. But, so yeah, you see this on both sides. I think probably more so on the right, but that's just because it's a right-wing idea in the first place, right?
Right.
But that, to me, seems to miss the really most important insight that Nietzsche had, which that insight is that the whole point of this whole genealogy, this whole talking about, you know, how moral valuations originate in the first place in resentment, is that they're constructs. Moralities are constructs. They're made. Oftentimes they're made unconsciously and adopted unconsciously. And that's, you know, probably why we think they're not. We think that they're just natural, or they're just on the state of nature, or they're just intrinsic. But they are constructed over time. And if they're constructed, that means they can be deconstructed and then reconstructed and built again. And so, you know, does that give us like a promise of exactly how to do that? Not necessarily, right? But it does hold out the hope that it doesn't have to be that way. It's a contingent fact of the way things are, not a necessary one. And so if that's the case, that's actually a freeing thing, because that means we can do it otherwise. If we try, at least try to. I mean, we'll probably fail most times, but we can try to make it different. And that seems to me, as open-ended and vague as that is, it's at least true that there's no reason why we absolutely have to just buckle down and, you know, fuck everyone else and try to get our own, or just stick into our tribal identities and go from there. Even the tribal identities themselves are constructed, so we can deconstruct and reconstruct those too. It seems to me much more promising to at least try to do that, or at least try to think about how to do that, than to just assume the worst.
Yeah, I can't remember what the quote is. There's a quote from Nietzsche who talks about the death of God and this idea of how it's freeing. And he talks about how you're like a rudderless boat that's just pushed out to sea. And I can't remember, but it's actually this really beautiful and haunting freedom that Nietzsche is trying to articulate through the process of the transvaluation of values, right? That's what he talks about, beyond good and evil. Right, it's this idea of beyond the sort of simple binary of master slave, and that when you kind of dispositionally realign yourself as this rudderless boat without a compass, it doesn't exactly have a map even, but that's okay because there are islands out there, so go explore them, you know. And then when you explore that island, go explore another, And then you can go back to that other island, and you can take what you've learned at the second island back to the first island, and then you go back to the second, and then go to the third, and then by the time you get to the tenth, you'll have gained all this knowledge, and you can go back to the first, because maybe the first island was great, and you can go back there and you can learn some things, and maybe when you go back to the first island, you realize that it's totally different. It wasn't an island, but it was actually a peninsula to a bigger island or something, you know? But it's this point that there is this open-ended freedom of exploration that we ought to revel in, And that ought to be the thing that motivates us and that impels us, rather than being compelled by these ideas of this sort of conservative idea that you talked about trying to weaponize ressentiment, but rather have a shift in our disposition that kind of opens us up to the freedom of the open waters, to kind of extend the metaphor further. And I think there's something beautiful in that, you know? I don't know. I really do. And I mean, just in a very superficial, practical sense, I don't think people are happy. Like, I really don't. Even watching someone like Anderson Cooper, who's whatever, he's charming enough. The people on the panel, they just seem so bitter and so angry with the system, with each other. Even the people who try to smile through it all. And I don't know, I got really influenced for a little while by, I think it's Marshall Rosenberg's Nonviolent Communication that I thought was really lovely. And he talks about how, you know, there's these real problems with how we communicate with each other. We don't listen to each other, for one, which is obviously a big problem. But it also has to do with kind of like this weaponization of just trying to kind of impose our own insecurities, which I think we could say that violent communication is just kind of like cut through with ressentiment. But if we could learn how to kind of live and embody this nonviolent communication that he talks about, I think there would be something, I don't know, I think it would really change how we engage with each other socially. Because we're stuck in it together, man. We are. We're fucking stuck in it together. So we got to figure out ways to try to reciprocally engage with one another positively rather than negatively. So I don't know, man. I've just been experiencing a lot of fatigue lately. I don't mean like I'm not getting out of bed fatigue, but I mean political fatigue, social fatigue. And in one sense, I think, like I said earlier, it's been freeing, but in another sense, it's been really discouraging. It really has. And I don't know, man.
Yeah, we were talking about empathy as being a a sort of limited resource a couple weeks ago on the show, right? Ressentiment is kind of like the flip side of that, right? It's probably a much more plentiful resource than empathy is, because it can feel so much. But even it is limited. Even that becomes fatiguing, and you just can't muster it anymore. I mean, if you watch somebody from the other tribe like kill your family, okay, that resentment's going to fuel you forever. But I mean, yeah. Trump being an idiot is just not going to fuel anything for very long. It's not even funny anymore. It's just sad. I mean, I use that ironically, sad. And so, yeah, there has to be something better that we can do. Every human being shares some valuations. Like, we all want the people that we love and care about to do well. And we want them to, you know, love us back and care about us. And we want others to know us, at least a few people to know us well and to care about our interests. And we care about theirs in return. And, like, there are so many things that we all share. If we just can promote a positive vision like that, people will, in large part, grab onto that. I mean, what happened in the UK last week is a pretty good example of that. The second that the Labour Party released a manifesto actually detailing a positive vision rather than a reactionary one, which is all the Democrats do in the United States, that was the sort of turning point of the polling, right? That's immediately where the Tories are up by, what, 20%, 20 points or something? And then started losing week by week over that, like, 5 weeks or whatever between calling for the election and the election. An actual positive vision that actually promotes the common good and that people can latch onto has a unifying force to it. It's not as easy as just present a positive vision, then you win. But that at least has to be the starting point, right?
Yeah, I agree, man. I agree. And it's just unfortunate that the voices that are calling for that type of programmatic upbuilding are the minority, you know, or they're laughed at, or they're mocked even by centrists. You know, they're mocked by the majority of people that have power, that have a voice, you know? And God, man, it's really, I don't know, I'm just tired of it. I'm tired of it, but at the same time, like I said, man, it is kind of invigorating because it makes me think, oh, I don't have to give a fuck about that anymore. I can actually put my energy, which I got a lot of, towards better and more creative uses. And that's really what I'm excited about, what I've been doing. I do that anyway. I'm quite proactive and I'm always creating things and working on projects. I mean, my ideas are always extending my ability to carry them out. But now it's like it's even more motivation because I feel like I'm – cutting myself. What is it? The mooring? Is that? I'm going to go back to the Nietzsche metaphor. I'm kind of cutting myself free from the things that are kind of like weighing me down. So, yeah, man. We got to write that book on heterodox Christianity, Troy. The Heretic's Guide to Christianity and How to Build Communities. Yeah. positive shit here on Owls at Dawn.
Speaking of positive shit, Austin, you have sticky leaves this week. So what's making you feel good?
Dude. Okay. So I know that I sounded maybe a little bit bummed out in the last segment. But I'll be completely honest, I actually am so pumped up. I have so many sticky leaves, dude. I'm so sticky. I got stickiness all over me. I don't even know how to choose. All right. I am covered in sticky. So I've got this book by Rene Girard that I've been reading. That could be a sticky leaf, but it's not going to be my sticky leaf. I've got a movie called Things to Come by Mia Hansen-Love that is fucking brilliant. One of my favorite movies that I've seen. That and The Red Turtle are my two favorite films of 2017 so far. Even though Things to Come, it was actually a 2016 film. I think it was released someplace in 2017. But anyway, it's fucking amazing. If you can see it, you can see it on Amazon. You can rent it there. That's what I did. It might be in theater somewhere at like a local art house theater. Check it out. It's fucking amazing. If you haven't seen The Red Turtle yet, see The Red Turtle! It's amazing. I had a religious experience, but that's not going to be my sticky leaves either. And then it's a tie between these other two. And I'm actually going to go with the weird one, but I'm going to talk a little bit about one before I go into the full sticky leaves. I read this book recently called Wanderlust by Rebecca Solnit that I think is absolutely fantastic. It's a history of walking. And she goes back to Rousseau and Kierkegaard and some of these early philosophers that talked about walking from a philosophical perspective or that used walking to kind of stimulate their thoughts. And then she kind of traces it back to the Peripatetics in ancient Greece. And then she kind of goes and she traces this wonderful historical and anthropological analysis through like the history of bipedalism. Like, why did we go from walking on fours to walking on twos? And there are these crazy theories. My favorite crazy theory was by Lovejoy, who he's pretty much mocked now, but he says that basically the reason is so that males who have their genitalia exposed, unlike most animals in the animal kingdom, they stood up on two legs so that they could ward off potential threats that would want to mate with their woman. So it was about the protection of monogamy. And so they would stand up to show their dick to the opposing guy. That's his theory. It's his theory about how bipedalism happened, is that because you wanted to show your junk to a potential dude that was going to come and try to hit on your chick.
That seems pretty risky, man.
I know. It's super risky for one, and two, it's like super patriarchal and misogynist, and so it's kind of crazy. But, you know, there are other theories too. But then it kind of talks about the sort of heyday of walking as leisure in the work of Wordsworth, which was really interesting because I studied Wordsworth in undergrad, but from a real like romantic perspective, I didn't realize that Wordsworth was actually kind of a political revolutionary in his younger years. So she talks about how walking was really important for him and his sister and a lot of his early writings in the late 1700s at the turn of the 18th century there. And then, of course, he became kind of boring in his later sort of pure romantic years. But and then, you know, it kind of extends from there. But it's a wonderful book. It talks about like contemporary walking, urban walking, her own experiences walking. So there's also a sort of like memoir element. Fantastic book. Check it out. Wanderlust by Rebecca Solnit. But now here's my real sticky leaves. And it's not even the best thing that I have experienced, but it is the thing that has stuck with me in the most profound sense. And it is a movie that was called Childhood of a Leader. Did you see The Childhood of a Leader, directed by Brady Corbett?
Never even heard of this.
All right, so it's written and directed by Brady Corbett, and I think co-written by his partner. I can't remember her name right now. I'm sorry. But it is based off of a short story by Jean-Paul Sartre called The Childhood of a Leader from a collection of stories that he wrote. And it is a phenomenological exploration of a would-be fascist. So it's about a young boy during the end of World War I whose father is a diplomat. He works for Woodrow Wilson. and he is engaged in peace talks. What is it? The Treaty of Versailles. And so they are living in France, and his mother is, I believe she's French. Yes, she is. She's French. And it is about this young boy who looks like a girl and about his experiences as a child, all the while knowing that he is going to become some sort of fascist leader one day. And it's got a little twist at the end, so I don't want to say anything about that. But I will say that it takes place in sort of three chapters and then a sort of overture. It's got an overture, three chapters, and then a sort of epilogue at the end. And if contemporary films are boring and filled with ressentiment themselves, this is a sort of conceptual burst of freedom. It wasn't the most compelling narrative. It wasn't the most gripping story. It wasn't like I was glued to my seat. There were even times when, you know, I kind of like my attention wandered. But for some reason, it has stuck with me in like the most profound way. The soundtrack is haunting and shrill and jarring. And so it's very emotive in that sense. Oh, not the soundtrack, I should say the composition, because it's all original accompaniment. And the acting is obviously brilliant. It's Bernice Bejo is the mom. She was the lead in A Knight's Tale back in the day. And she's the love interest, I should say, in A Knight's Tale. And she was the lead, or again, the love interest, but the lead female in The Artist, if you remember that a couple of years ago. And then Liam Cunningham plays the father, and then the young boy, I can't remember. But then Robert Pattinson of Twilight fame actually has a role in it, a small but very important role. And it's just fucking brilliant, man. It isn't trying to like explain or justify how fascism emerges or why necessarily this boy becomes a fascist. It's not like a psychoanalytic approach. It's much more of a phenomenological just display of this young boy's childhood experiences, knowing that he will become a fascist. And there's something so interesting about it because we know the conclusion already. It's kind of like irreversible, right? If you know the conclusion, can the beginning be a happy beginning? Or if it kind of goes in reverse, can the ending be happy even though you kind of already know the trauma that kind of like took place? And it kind of has a similar effect. You know the ending. He's going to become a fascist later. So who the fuck is this young boy? And it handles the material, I think, with such delicacy. And it's filmed so in such a wonderful it's very slow moving, which I enjoy a lot of, depending on what mood you're in. You've got to be caffeined up. But it's just a very sort of lovely exploration of these concepts and these themes and of humanity and of struggle and of familial tension and of political development. And I just thought it was fan-fucking-tastic. And Brady Corbett, dude, I'm so jealous of this guy. This is my ressentiment right here. This is my mimetic desire. He has the career that I would love to have in the entertainment world. I mean, granted, he doesn't have like the academic stuff, but in the entertainment world, he like works with Michael Haneke, Lars von Trier. I mean, those are the guys. He was in the movie 13 way back in the day. I don't know if you remember who he is, guys, but he's fucking fantastic. But he works with like just independent art house giants. And then his first feature film is an adaptation of a Jean-Paul Sartre story. So fuck that guy. No, I love you, Brady Corbett. You're fantastic. Keep doing your thing, brother.
Did you just Sig Heil him?
No. Amening. That's a praise. That's a praise hand. That's a hallelujah hand.
There's a thin line between praise hands and Sig Heils.
No, it's my Pentecostal hand, man. So you haven't even heard of it?
I've never heard of it at all. I'm gonna check it out definitely now.
Dude, it is so good. That and Things to Come. Things to Come is, I just think, it's a brilliant movie. I mean, Isabella Huppert is what acting should be in this world. Like, she literally is perfect. You know, people want to talk about Meryl Streep. They want to talk about Daniel Day-Lewis. Fucking Isabella Huppert is the best actress of our generation. She is fucking phenomenal. She's like Brando phenomenal. Like, people will be talking about her in 30 years like people talk about Brando now. She's absolutely amazing. And this film, she's perfect. And the story is fucking brilliant. And not only that, but she plays a philosophy professor who's married to a philosophy professor.
Is it better than that Woody Allen movie about Joaquin Phoenix being a philosophy professor who has sex with, like, freshmen?
Yeah, much better. Much better. But yeah, so that's a better movie. But for some reason, The Childhood of a Leader just it stuck with me more, you know? And of course, Corbett has talked about it in interviews. Or Corbet, I think he actually says. I think he pronounces it Brady Corbet, so I apologize. But he's, you know, said in interviews that it's really interesting because he started writing this about 10 years ago before Donald Trump came into office. But at the same time, he says he thinks that there are some interesting things, you know, in the era of Trump or in the era of Wilders in the Netherlands and stuff, and in the rise or in the era of what is it, the National Front in France, that are kind of interesting, you know, that he was able to explore this through this medium and kind of anticipate, if you will, a lot of this resurgent fascism or neo-fascism. And so it's very interesting, and I think it's very timely. It's not something that's going to teach, though. You know, that's the thing that I love about it. It's more of a tone or a feel of the fascistic self, you know, or of the fascistic desire or the fascistic force than it is like, this is where fascism comes from, or this is why someone becomes a fascist, or this is what fascism is. It's less of that, you know, and it's more tonal.
I like that you said it was phenomenological rather than psychoanalytic.
Yeah.
Because when you were describing the plot or the basic concept of the movie, I'm like, oh man, that psychoanalytic approach is what I'm assuming it was going to be. And that seems kind of boring to me because it's been done so many times, right?
Right.
But that phenomenological approach seems a lot more interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. So definitely check it out. I rented that on Amazon for like $3. So check that shit out. Sticky leaves, you'll be all up in fascism.
Right, so for our bullshitting segment, what do you want to bullshit about, Austin?
What do I want to bullshit about? We could bullshit about the NBA finals.
We talk about basketball too much in this podcast.
Okay, we don't talk about basketball. I do want to say this though, I won the bet. People don't know, but off air, Troy wanted to make a bet about who would win the finals and in how many games, and he said the Golden State Warriors in 6. I said the Golden State Warriors in 5. I'm better at basketball than Troy, is what that means. But I think that we should bullshit about Wonder Woman. Have you seen Wonder Woman?
No, I have not. Have
Are you?
You
going to see Wonder Woman? I have not seen it.
Maybe.
Maybe you'll go see it.
But I mean, we should only bullshit about things that we don't actually know about, so.
Okay. Yeah, that's true. That's true. But I mean, that doesn't mean you can't go see it later.
Maybe. Only after. So you're not going to confirm my hypotheses.
What are your hypotheses? That you're a misogynist and you hate women and that you're like praising the patriarchy?
Why would it be a hypothesis about things that are true about me? No. It's about the cultural impact of the actual cultural object.
Okay.
So.
Explain.
Is Wonder Woman a the triumphant ascendancy of feminism? B, some lean-in bullshit, or C, identity politics is trash and it's just cash grabs by corporate giants?
It's a combination of B and C.
Okay, how's that?
So I do think that it is like some lean-in feminist bullshit. You know, I'm not 100% convinced that that a woman Christ figure perpetuating the myth of metaphysical dualism and the sort of monomyths of Western culture is some sort of triumph of the feminine. I think that – and of course I'm saying this based on reviews and not having seen it, so I don't know. But I highly doubt it that a DC superhero movie is going to be some sort of transformative, positive expression of feminism like a film like The Handmaiden is, or like – a film like Young Adult is, or like a film like Jean Dielman by Chantal Ackerman is. But I will say this. It is also a cash grab by studios who are trying to capitalize on the moment. But at the same time, here's something that's very positive about the movie. Directed by a female filmmaker who is now going to basically just probably be given carte blanche to do whatever the fuck she wants in the film world. So that's good, which means it creates more opportunities and more employment situations for women in Hollywood, which is obviously an important thing, but again, important in what way? For like the lean-in feminists so that they can be like, yeah, now we can become corporate oppressors too? I don't know. right? So I'm torn because, yeah, I'm sure it's got some good shit. But, yeah, it's definitely going to kind of just perpetuate the capitalist structures. So, you know, I don't know.
That was a pretty good attempt. Okay. A for effort. But the answer was actually D.
Which is
don't give a shit. Because DC movies suck ass and nobody should care. No, I mean, I've heard as much as I hate all DC movies and basically all superhero movies now, I just want them to all go away. I've heard that it's really fun and escapes a lot of the dark, false, like, dreariness and grayness of the Zack Snyder movies, which is a welcoming thing. I'll probably watch it at some point when it's closer to free.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not going to be, like, crusading against it or for it. Who really cares? It's just a movie.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. I mean, I have heard some people say that there's some interesting stuff about female embodiment in it that are good. You know, like Merleau-Ponty and motility and shit, you know? Because, like, when she does, like, the superhero landing, you know, like, her thighs, like, jiggle. So it's actually, it's not trying to, like, idealize the female form as much. But at the same time, she's also wearing, like, a bust where, like, her boobs are hanging out. And she's, like, absolutely gorgeous female.
Yeah, it's so, also, I mean, Gal Gadot. I mean, talk about.
Yeah, she's Gal Gadot. So she's, like. She's, like, clearly a sexualized image. And this Wonder Woman in general. I mean, look at the old Linda Carter suit. You know, Wonder Woman is a sexualized female heroine. So yeah, it may in some ways present some interesting ideas about female embodiment. But at the same time, I'm not sure that this is, like, the thing that is going to release the freedom of femininity, you know? No, but with that said... Could this be a link in the chain that contributes to more empowerment for women that then eventually creates and releases some sort of positive feminine potential? Sure, possibly. I won't hate on it for potentially having that. But at the same time, I'm not the one that's, like, sitting there saying, like, wow, this is the greatest movie ever made and this is the greatest thing that's ever happened to women. Buffy the Vampire Slayer, motherfuckers! What about that shit?
Yeah, and that's where you gotta go for a true femininity right there, right, dude?
Yeah, come on! But I'm honestly, like, all jokes and everything aside, I say this with no humor, no sarcasm, no levity. I am so fucking sick and tired of superhero movies. I am so sick of them, man. I am so tired of them. They are so boring. Come on. Maybe that's why a film like The Childhood of the Leader to me is so interesting, because it's not a fucking superhero movie. Jesus. Fuck superhero movies. I just want to hear good stories and experience good concepts and see good filmmaking. And I'm tired of superheroes. With that said, I did make a video that is on Wisecrack about the superhero film Logan that I helped co-craft. So you can go check that out. Plug, plug. But that's the last superhero thing I'm ever going to talk about.
Yeah, that was really good. And because it's a deconstruction of superheroes. So, you know.
Yeah.
Logan was badass.
All right. Well, yeah, that's our take on Wonder Woman. If you disagree with us, if you think that Troy is just being a misogynist asshole, well, please let us know on Twitter.
I said I'm going to watch it.
If you think that he's being a dick, just let us know on Twitter. @Owls_at_Dawn. We need to hear it. We need help, guys. We need help from our female audience. So Jess, Diana, any ladies out there that are listening, communicate with us. Let us know what you think.
If you think I'm being a misogynist dick, just @@AustinHaydenSmith. All right? Thank you.
All right, sick. So are we going to kick it over to Michael for This Week in Hip Hop?
Yep.
All right, Michael, what's going on this week in hip hop? I have a feeling there are some releases. And for those of you that don't know, Michael is in the middle of a big move right now. He is leaving England and moving back to Los Angeles, where he once lived a long time ago. Well, he was in Orange County, but he swore he would never go again. But now he's going back to the great land of opportunity to go be a comedy writer. He's leaving the world of academic philosophy for a little bit. So what is inspiring him in his move? That's what I want to know. Michael, what's up?
The prodigal returns.
Hey, what's up, Owls at Dawn, friends, listeners, and family? It's Michael Burns with This Week in Hip Hop. A lot of stuff going on this week. I'm going to focus on the album that came out that I'm the most excited about, and of course talk a little bit about the sad very sad news in hip-hop this week. If you like hip-hop, you already know what I'm talking about. First things first, a record that came out a week or two ago now that's at least worth mentioning is SZA's record, Control, came out on TDE. This one has been in the works for a while. There was some kind of debate and curiosity around whether or not it would come out, but it did, and it's good. While it's not a hip-hop record per se, it's full of really good production, very lush, some kind of like indie rock influence very clear on the project. Includes guest verses by Kendrick Lamar, Isaiah Rashad. Listen to it if you haven't. It's good all the way through, no excuses. And if you need a starting point, fuck it. Listen to Doves in the Wind, the track featuring Kendrick. The record I am most excited to talk about this week, and if you've listened to this segment on this podcast at all, you know that I love this rapper. If this is the first time you haven't fast-forwarded past this, thank you. Nice to meet you. You're going to hear about it in a second. But 2 Chainz. 2 Chainz has a new record. It just came out. It's called Pretty Girls Like Trap Music. 2 Chainz himself has referred to the sound on this album as top-tier yacht music. But man, he's one of the most special artists in hip-hop. He's been for a while, even if you didn't notice. And on this record, he really succeeds, not by playing to any trends or label-based demands, but rather he leans into precisely what has always made the artist formerly known as Titty Boy successful. Ridiculous confidence, knowingly hilarious wordplay and metaphors, and insanely specific references to signifiers of opulence. Now, if I were prone to hot takes, which I absolutely fucking am, I would say that 2 Chainz is the perfecter of a style of hip-hop that has long eluded King Yeezus himself. And I think this has eluded King Yeezus ever since the Cruel Summer album came out, a project where the effortless cool of 2 Chainz was really put on full mainstream display. But I think as Kanye and others have learned in recent years, the sort of je ne sais quoi of Titty Boy's unique style of cool isn't something you can purchase. And that's what makes 2 Chainz' voice so powerful, because it's his and his alone, and all the attempts to replicate it end in awkward failures. Also, footnote, in case you don't know, his original rap name was Titty Boy. That's why I keep saying that. But Pretty Girls Like Trap Music throughout is an elevation in a certain sense of the trap genre, while also being the most kind of clear statement of 2 Chainz' style without anything else going on. There's not a lot of obvious forced collaborations or ploys at radio attention on this record. Great, fun lyric stuff. As always, we get to hear 2 Chainz rhyme Black Activist with Black Asticus. Fun lines that you would want to write in Valentine's cards to your sweetheart, like fuck her to sleep, she had a pipe dream. But either way, it's a really strong record. My favorite tracks, Riverdale Road, 4 AM, Blue Cheese, which is the one featuring Migos, and then the final track, Burglar Bars, featuring Monica. So that's pretty cool to get Monica on the record right there. But once again, I think this is genuinely a record that you can listen to throughout. It's not just a collection of singles with filler. And as a final comment on 2 Chainz and Pretty Girls Like Trap Music, I love old rappers. It's another thing I've talked about in the segment before. And I especially love old rappers that didn't get big until they were in their 30s and continued to just get better. So maybe it's just me, but when I listen to 2 Chainz, I find myself thinking, huh, if he can pull some stuff off, maybe I can do new and better shit as I creep towards the age of irrelevance. So if you're, I don't know, a slightly older individual and you need some motivation to try to do new things in your life, maybe listen to 2 Chainz and let that be a soundtrack for those pursuits. My second foreign car, it was a Bing. My third foreign car, it was a Porsche. My fourth foreign car, you can afford. My pocket brain and don't want no abortion. My draw got them horses, my car got them horses. Rocking some products like they was at force. We had no choices. Ripped that, he with that, she with that, you and that, I with that same old nigga. Yeah. Another record that came out this week, I guess I kind of have to at least mention, would be Young Thug's Beautiful Thugger Girls. And yeah, it's surprisingly fun to listen to. I've always been annoyed as shit by Young Thug, especially early on in his career, as I think he embodied a kind of razor-thin, pop-friendly mumble rap that threatened to ruin the entire genre. I'm only kind of kidding. But it seems like his lack of full-on mainstream success has actually worked in his favor, as he's developed a style of sing-songy, rap-adjacent music that's catchy as hell and enjoyable to listen to. Music doesn't have depth, but what it lacks in depth, it makes up for in being highly listenable. Let me tell you what I mean. Last week, I'm having a barbecue with my roommates. I randomly pick up a bag of Doritos while buying beer. After not eating Doritos for at least, I'd say, 10 years. Now, the second I pour these orange-dusted sons of bitches into a bowl and put it on the table, everyone around it started feeding like a bunch of small-town Ohio opioid addicts. Now, it's not that Doritos are particularly interesting on the palate. They don't represent the future of corn-based artificial snacks. But you can chill and eat these things for hours and enjoy the shit out of it. That is basically how I feel about Young Thug and his music. It's Doritos music. And it is what it is, but it can be pretty fun. So I would say if you're chilling out this summer, enjoying the current heat wave, depending on where you live, putting on Beautiful Thugger Girls is fun. It's not particularly good rap music, but it's good for what it is, and it won't leave orange dust on your fingers. So check that out. I won't even say favorite tracks, because for me, not a ton of standouts. I mean, I liked She Wanna Party. I liked the one featuring Future, but whatever. Listen to it if you want. Now, on a very opposite note, we'll close with this. Very sad news. Prodigy of Mobb Deep passed away yesterday, June 20th, at the age of 42. Legendary Queensbridge rapper. Really helped create the grimy street poetics of New York rap while in Mobb Deep. Still putting out really strong music. And for listeners of this podcast, you might like that. One of his last projects that came out this year is called Hegelian Dialectics. And I just think in the current era of street fabrication and rapper as the salesman of tall tales, Prodigy is one of the last dudes who really lived his lines. And he let listeners into a world that would make most of us shit our pants in real life. He had a wisdom and a seriousness about him since he was a teenager, and never really slowed down throughout his career, and did a bunch of fun shit too. After he got out of jail for a bit, he released a prison cookbook. But either way, I hope that you've listened to more than just Shook Ones in your day, but if you haven't, dig back into both Mobb Deep's catalog and Prodigy's solo material. He's really going to be missed in the hip-hop community, someone that it really wasn't original and added a lot to the genre. So go listen to some Mobb Deep in particular, and some of the recent Prodigy stuff this week. So Prodigy, rest in peace. That's This Week in Hip-Hop from me, Michael Burns. Thank you as always to the guys at the Owls of Dawn podcast. I will catch you all soon. Bye. My skin is thick, cause I'll be up in the mix of action. If I'm not at home, puffin' live, relaxing. New York got a nigga depressed, so I wear a slug proof underneath my guest. God bless my soul before I put my foot down and begin to stroll into the drop. Alright, thanks for that, Michael. You listened to that new Young Thug album?
You mean did I eat some Doritos?
Did you hold your guitar upside down?
Did I get that orange dust on my soul? No, I did not. Did you?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I feel like just some old white guy, but I can't get into some of this new trap stuff.
Oh, no?
No, I mean, like, it just doesn't, it's not for me.
Well, is that the Young Thug or is that the 2 Chainz album?
Both.
Okay.
But I know that, you don't... 2 Chainz is 2 Chainz. Like, everyone just knows what that guy's about, right? But I think the Young Thug album's getting a lot of, like, critical attention or something. But,
is it?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, maybe I need to go back and, like, find the genealogy of where the stuff comes from to really get it, but it just, I don't know, it just sounds like club rap.
Yeah, maybe you need to just get your stick out of your ass and embrace the flows of club life, dude.
Apparently.
Come on.
Yeah.
Apparently.
But then again, like, the new Lord album is, like, the big shit right now, and I just can't get into that either, so.
No, man, that's not my vibe. You know, there was this great, well, I guess it was a sort of pseudo joke analysis, but the sort of Lord phenomenon, I think my biggest issue is that she sounds like everybody else. There's like this indie girl voice that has become really popular with the way that they say their words, which I think is actually – I have a theory on this. It comes from like Regina Spektor and Ingrid Michaelson and that stuff that was really popular. But I think that they're all emulating Bjork. So you get all these like English and American and Irish indie women singers that are singing like an Icelandic woman. Because it is. It's like the way that they say their O's and their A's and their vowel pronunciations are very Bjork-like. And so I feel like everybody that was inspired by Bjork – like 10, 15 years ago, inspired this new generation of indie girls. And so it's kind of like, and there's also this like weird influence, I think, that comes from like the punk guys, you know, like the Fall Out Boys and shit like that, that were inspired by Green Day, who were trying to sound like they were British, even though they were American. So there's this weird like vowel enunciation, right? And I don't know, man, I just can't do it. It is like nails on a chalkboard to me when I hear this just new... The horde, that's the thing, is like there's a horde of them. If it were just like a couple people, I'd be like, oh, okay, that's kind of cool. But it's like everybody is just emulating each other. This is fucking imitation, mimetic desire. Rene Girard, he's right.
Yeah, I never thought about that with Bjork. I'll have to go back and see if I can place that. It's interesting. I mean, obviously Bjork is, her, you know, vocal stylings are very radio unfriendly and are not right. Poppy at all. But yeah, as like a watered down version of that. That sounds kind of interesting. But yeah, I mean, for me, it's just that writ large. There's just, like, the new Lorde album. Like, I listen to the few songs, and, like, I get why people like this. It's better than most pop music. But that's right. Still, like, not good. I mean, not just that it's not good. It's
right.
Just because it goes into an arena where everything's shitty, and it's okay. Like, relatively speaking, I guess that makes it great. But I mean, there's so much else out there. I mean, like, I'm going to bust out the new Vince Staples record when it comes out in a couple days. That's going to be the shit. I just know it. I'm not going to, like, spend my time with... I guess, you know, if you're really into hip-hop, then, you know, Doritos are great sometimes. And then and then you graduate to, like, what's Vince Staples? Like, pita chips or some shit like that?
Right.
I don't know how it works in the analogy. But
and then what is someone like... I don't know. What is someone like, okay, like Prodigy from Mobb Deep? Is he, like gourmet... croissants, like fresh off the bakery rack? Like, how does this analogy keep going?
Oh yeah, fuck yeah, man. I mean, go back and listen to Mobb Deep's Infamous. Like, obviously I'm not a hip-hop head, but even if you don't really into the history of hip-hop, you can listen to the Infamous and be like, okay, I get it. Like, this is real shit,
right?
And I don't know, it's hard to get that vibe from a lot of pop music today, both on the hip-hop side and on the regular pop side.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm less attuned to the music world these days than as I am to the film and TV world. And I feel that same way about film and TV. Like, that's why, you know, we were kind of talking and kind of shitting on Wonder Woman. But ultimately, I think part of the reason that I'm not interested in Wonder Woman is just because I have fatigue of summer blockbuster movies. I have superhero fatigue. I have fatigue of these... formulaic movies that I understand how they're made. I understand the production process. And then at the same time, I've also seen a million of them. So for me, I feel like life is too short for shitty movies, which is also, I think, Mubi's slogan, which I love. But life is too short for me to spend my time because there's so much out there that, like, you know, I got to be a little bit selective. And yeah, I can deal with some Doritos every now and then. That's cool. I'm down on a sunny day. I got a Corona in my hand and there's a bowl of Doritos because it's a going away party. Give me some fucking Doritos. But I'm going to say 90% of the time, I'm trying to be more selective and more – I'm trying to work on my selection mechanisms so that I can be more efficient and also stimulate more pleasure at the same time.
Yeah, I mean that makes sense though. That's kind of a challenge to what I'm saying here is even I – There's some area where everyone has their Doritos, you know, and when it comes to media consumption. Like, I fucking watched the Prison Break reboot, knowing that I hated that show when it first came out.
Right.
But I still watched it because it was familiar and I need something to, like, veg out to every once in a while. And it was god-awful, but I still fucking watched it. So that's what it is.
Yeah, you just got to find your Doritos, and then, you know what? Eat the shit out of them when you do find them. That's cool. We won't judge you.
Just don't have a diet of junk food, because then you die of heart disease.
Exactly. This is a brilliant metaphor, Troy. God, you should write a book.
No, Michael came up with that, man.
Well, the art, real art, and a real artist is when you steal shit. Isn't that what they say? They're like, like pretty good art is borrowing, and then like the excellent artists steal. So thanks, Michael. All right, cool. Well, we'll go ahead and wrap up the segment. Thank you so much for tuning in to another episode of Owls at Dawn. We will be back next week. I think we are going to be talking about religion and myth and things like that with Rene Girard. Does that sound about right, Troy?
Yeah. Going
to try and delve into some of that shit? Cool. Sounds good. In the meantime, you can check us out, owls_at_dawn, at both Twitter and Instagram. You can shoot us an email, owls@dawnpodcast@gmail.com. And I don't think I'm forgetting anything. Oh, iTunes. You can leave us a 5-star rating and a little review. That would be nice. Helps bump our statistics up a bit, which is always helpful. It's like currency for us. And I think that's it.
That's Donnie America.